or raise you were anticipating, or you weren't able to pivot your business as effectively as you'd hoped. You may be behind on your goals. These are bummers for sure, but reframing how you think about it can build patience. This comes from Dr. Natalie Underdown, an executive coach and organizational psychologist. To do this, she suggests asking yourself questions like, how can I make the most of this time anyway? How can I use what I'm experiencing right now to grow? How can I allow this to make me stronger, better positioned to get what I really want? How can I use this experience to help others? What opportunities would never have presented themselves had I not been forced to slow down and take a detour? If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, evaluate where you are on your journey to self-discovery. To do so requires a little self-awareness. Is this a good place to stop and dig in for a while to better understand yourself and others? No need to rush. You set the pace. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. Someone threw until the path was clear. That's when I found you. How I wound up here. All I needed was a rock that I could lean on. All you needed was something. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
KBOO's end of year drive is happening right now. We invite you to become a member today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. Contribute now and help us meet our $70,000 goal by the end of the year. Join the KBOO family today at kboo.fm/give.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, what the hell is nuclear fusion and why do we need it when we have solar? And the fight to make public key documents regarding the most controversial assassination in American history, that's the Dallas mid-afternoon murder of JFK. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, the People's Radio Network here in the Bay Area, KPFA. What an honor it is to have these free speech airwaves and to have you along with us today. And we're delighted also to welcome back a good friend of the show, attorney Bill Simpich. Bill Simpich is a civil rights attorney in the East Bay here in the Bay Area. Since the 1980s, his work has centered around housing, employment, and governmental misconduct, particularly within the military and intelligence agencies. Yeah, well, he helped to represent a friend of mine, the late Judy Berry, in a very successful case against the FBI and the Oakland Police Department. In recent years, he has focused on the overclassification of government documents. The granddaddy of overclassification has always been the JFK case. Besides the problems with the story around the violent death, the JFK documents include revelations about about wiretapping within dozens of foreign government embassies. We don't do that, do we? Oh, no, Bill, we couldn't. Anyway, we are delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Mr. William Simpich. Bill, welcome back.
Dennis, thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Well, let's pick it up from October. Last we spoke, you were part of a crew that was suing the Biden administration to essentially follow the decisions that were made. What this was a congressional decision to release these documents. Or set up the scene for us.
Yes, it was Act of Congress 30 years ago after Oliver Stone's movie came out, challenging people to get the documents released. And the movie's call was successful. It was unanimous in Congress. One of the strongest laws about declassifying documents ever created. It even goes so far as to take away prosecutorial discretion regarding release of their, you know, deliberative documents. You get to see inside the room as they decide whether or not to declassify these. Unheard of power in a statute. Unheard of power for the right to know. And it's an example that's been taken up by the Cold Case Act, which has loosened up the lynching documents in the last couple of years. And that's another story. But it's very powerful to see how the JFK case has affected declassification efforts.
And I want to talk about sort of some of the content in one moment, but just to set the scene, this is very interesting in that you're not simply surrounded by leftists wanting this information. This is one of the reasons you got some punch on this fight, and we'll talk a little bit about that too, is because you got a whole bunch of right-wingers who are engaged. A lot of people want to know what happened.
It really does kind of boil down to that. To some extent, it's a generational thing for those of us who were young and remember what happened. And for other reasons, whether you're on the left or the right, people with good reason are concerned about the power of big government and who watches the watchers.
Right. Okay. Tell us about why. I mean, you know, isn't the Kennedy thing, you know, this is how it goes, the line, isn't the Kennedy thing a bunch of crazies who want to, you know, make up something that didn't happen about somebody did what, and we already know everything we need to know, and, you know, let's move on. Well, what do we need to know? What would be important historically to know? What might you expect to get from these documents?
Well, the one that always has leapt out for me is when Hoover and LBJ talked the day after Kennedy was killed. Hoover says, you know, we've got wiretaps and can hear Oswald's voice, and it's not the same voice as the tapes we have of him here at home. So that's and he goes, in other words, it sounds like two men were down there that day. So the notion that Oswald was impersonated was so powerful for me, I wrote a whole book trying to figure it out, which I think I did to my own satisfaction. I think he was impersonated, at least on the telephone. That's pretty strong stuff coming out of Hoover and LBJ's mouth. And it's not the kind of story that's been picked up by the media in a big way, because they don't know how to handle it, which is understandable. They don't, you know, reporters, as you know, are best on a deadline, but they're not at their best when they're trying to follow a long, complicated story.
And one that has some depth to it and has to be understood in the larger context which you approach it, which is, this is about, you know, everybody's talking about good government, and everybody, you know, Trump has now become the lightning rod, and he deserves to be for being the freak that he is. You know, critical thinking, questioning, reporting about history, you know, the reporters are supposed to be the first cut on history, but if they're owned and they become stenographers and spokespeople for foreign policy, for, you know, for the State Department, then it becomes problematic. And that's where you come in, and the folks who really want to go deep and get the necessary documentation to understand what our history is, what happened, so we don't, for instance, do it again, right? This is where this goes.
I mean, people like Bob Perry, for example, I think are an exemplar of what you're saying. People like yourself and Bob Perry and others kept blowing the whistle during the Central American Wars of the 1980s. And what happened to Bob Perry? At one point, he was reduced to selling suits as Robert Hall because no one would cover his journalist. And right. He wasn't a conspiracy theorist. That was a phrase made up by the CIA a long time ago. But I'll tell you where the notion of conspiracy theorists has really come up and bitten everybody in the butt recently has been the fact we just don't have enough information about this case like we don't about a whole bunch of different matters. And when it comes up in a situation of a pandemic where people are terrified, conspiracy theories run rampant because people don't know what to believe anymore. And it's because they don't have access to good enough information. And, you know, this whole anti-vaxxer thing, I will tell you right now, I think it's a tragedy. But I think it's made the newspaper people and the journalists sit up and say, we've got to focus on getting better information to people.
Oh, absolutely. Well, listen now, talk to us a little bit about we hear from the Biden administration that you got, you know, more than 90% of the documents, you know, what's left over is just really stuff we have to consider. It's national security. So what's your problem with that?
Well, most of it is old wine and new bottles, literally the same documents being recycled over and over again from different files, or documents that had 7 redactions being winnowed down to 5 or 6 redactions. In other words, we got very little new material in this last batch, very similar to what we've gotten in the previous 4 batches. There's when you get right down to it, we think they're holding the best for last. And we think that we need new searches done. Over the last 30 years, so we have far more powerful search capabilities. We also know what documents were willfully or negligently not provided the first time around. So we need at least one more pass through all the agencies to make sure we've got what's of value. And to that end, we filed a lawsuit against the Biden administration and the National Archives. And we feel very strongly that we've got a powerful case to be made in both areas. And I can get into the details if you like. But the important thing...
Yeah, in one moment, but just there are indications that something is new here. Well, it is interesting that the historian of choice of sort of everybody, Michael Bluth, what's his name? Beth Kloss. I can't pronounce his name. But he is sort of the resident historian. He has actually jumped in now, right? He's getting a little bit more interested in folks like him who are sort of, you know, bring in the mainstream.
Beschloss has been unwilling, like a lot of people, to talk about this case because it's considered a career killer among journalists. And Beschloss, as the dean of the historians, quote-unquote, treasures his reputation more than anything else. And so to see him let his hair down this week and admit that the FBI and LBJ and others engaged in what he called, what the CIA referred to as, in their own words from their historian, as a benign cover-up, so that World War III wouldn't be ignited as a result of the alleged Marxist being the alleged killer, who was a Cuba activist. It's pretty clear that, you know, they were ready to, the military was ready to attack Cuba at a moment's notice if there was a good excuse. And, there was a lot of action taken to prevent that from happening by people all the way up in the government. So it was a wild time. And Beschloss gets that story right.
All right, let me jump in now and say we're speaking with Mr. Bill Simpich. He's an attorney. He's a civil rights attorney. He's based here in the Bay Area. And he's been tracking the JFK case and the assassination documents since really the beginning. He's written extensively about it. Bill, let's take a few minutes. Talk about what you think might be missing and why it's important to fill in these particular blanks?
Well, it's a Cold War history at the end of the day. It's very exciting for those of us who grew up during it. It's also exciting for those of us today who have to tackle the scourges of our age, like racism and the drug war and overclassification and all the rest of capitalism's horrors. And to that end, when you read these documents, I mean, the new documents, for example, talk about how the CIA went after people of color, who were working with the Black Panthers and similar organizations, because all those documents got tossed in willy-nilly with the Kennedy documents, because they were involved in overlapping programs, you know, involving CIA activities, you know, whether it's COINTELPRO on the FBI side or the CIA's equivalent program. And it kind of goes from there. It's a fascinating snapshot. So no matter what your politics are, dipping into these documents in a focused way is really valuable. And I'm lucky enough to work with the Mary Farrell Foundation. We spend most of our time weeding through the document and explain what the programs are that the CIA had going during that era, so you can glance at a moment and understand what their interrogation programs were, such as Artichoke, which was used originally against World War II prisoners, which wound up being used in our own country as, you know, virtual hypnosis type, you know, mind control experiment, you know, done on people in, you know, psychiatric institutions. And this has nothing to do per se with the Kennedy case, again. But these are all documents that get, you know, fleshed out in the hunt. That's why this history is so bad. Yeah.
Interesting. Really, you know, interesting stuff. Now, you touched on this, and let's come back to it for a moment, because it's we talk about why is this relevant? Why is it relevant, for instance, to still understand, but that the FBI is largely, you know, in terms of agents, special agents, it's like 2% black or something. There are still essentially no black people in the FBI. Now, there's one or two sprinkling here and there, but these agencies are very white. And so when it comes, for instance, to in the beginning to investigate the new Republican Party, if you will, and the new violence that's behind it, they're slow to the take, right? You know, if those were all black people invading the Capitol back in the January 6th land, how many dead people do we have, Bill?
Oh,
but
this is
the kind of stuff that comes up out of these documents, right?
Absolutely. The bias, the class bias and race bias of these agencies leaps right out at you from Jump Street. Most of the FBI, and in fact, back in the day, you had to be a lawyer to be a member of the FBI at a time when there was very few people of color in the legal profession as well. So these, you know, problems of race and class just and sexism just double and redouble on top of each other. And you really get a bird's eye view into American society of that era, and also how in this era, the same problems of overclassification completely make it impossible for us to come to the bottom of almost any investigation. The one that's the big exception right now is, you know, the events of January 6th. And why is that? Because you've got a partisan scalpel where the Democrats have control of the committee. And I'm not saying that's awful, but I am saying that, you know, that in a moment, there's a united zeal to actually get something done, and they're actually able to get to the bottom of it. But in most instances, whether it's because of bipartisan squabbling or national security concerns, the American people wind up like orphans. They don't know their own history, and they don't know where they came from. And it's the story of 9/11. It's the story of you know, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We never seem to be able to get to the bottom of what happened in these events. And a lot of the problem, certainly not the only problem, is our lack of access to the documents I don't know if you know this, Dennis, but the Freedom of Information Act is used more successfully by corporations and by individuals to get business dirt on each other.
Yeah. They're very good at that.
Yeah, they've got big money. They got big budgets. Yeah. They can hire lots of lawyers, you know, and they got the leverage. And that's where a lot of this material goes. You know, we can get to the end of the tobacco cases at the end because the lawyers get involved. They realize they can make billions of dollars litigating them. You know, the same with a number of other subjects, you know, what asbestos, what have you. But if it's a case about information, like Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, you know, all of a sudden we can't get to the bottom of it because there's no money in it.
It is interesting the way in which intelligence went after Occupation Wall Street as opposed to the way it went after, you know, Occupation Trump land. And the Tea Party.
The Tea Party got it. The Trump people got a pass. The only reason the Trump people got in trouble is because, in a sense, they pooped in their own nest when they attacked the Capitol. They got a lot of people mad at them.
All right, Bill, listen, before we run out of time, tell us, in terms of specifically the Kennedy assassination, what are the things you're really interested in finding out? You don't think the person who everybody thinks killed him?
Well, you know, as somebody who doesn't think, I think it would have taken a military sniper to kill the president. But like I always say, if you're not willing to think that Oswald did it alone, you're in the wrong business. You've got to stay flexible in your thinking, at least, as to what happened. You got to admit that you might be wrong. So that gets the conspiracy-type thinking out of the game, where you're trying to focus on facts and, you know, a real investigation. When you get there, one of the examples we're using in this lawsuit to get the judge's attention is we're pointing to the case of 44 documents that have been withheld by the CIA regarding George Ioannidis. Ioannidis was the handler of the Cuban exiles in 1963 in New Orleans and Miami. And the day of the president's killing, these same Cuban exiles had the skinny on Oswald, ready for the network to see, boom, 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 getting the story out there right away. You call it a cover story. But my point here is that 15 years later, when there was a deeper investigation done by the House Select Committee on Assassination, who did the CIA hire to keep the HSDA investigators in line when looking at the documents? Was George Ioannidis, who had handled these very Cuban exiles that were the center of the investigation. And when the investigators asked Mr. Ioannidis, could he tell them who was running these Cuban exiles? Instead of saying, "Oh, it was me," he said, "Oh, I'll get back to you on that." And he never did. And it took, you know, a couple decades to find out it was him. So now we're trying to get, and he got an award from the CIA after he retired. So it looks like he got an award for keeping the HSDA away from him. And so that's the object lesson in the way the CIA has operated, systemic refusal, if you will, to come up with the facts on this case, you know, including a long line of cover-up type activities. I'm not saying the CIA did it. I'm saying they're part of the systemic cover-up, making it impossible to find out what happened to everyone's satisfaction.
What about all this stuff around who might benefit? For instance, Kennedy came in. It was Bay of Pigs time. There was a lot he didn't know about. Who knows what he knew and when he knew it, but in terms of who has a reason to want him to disappear. And of course, if you come in the door of organized crime, it's Robert F. Kennedy. The run is that they needed to get rid of both Kennedys because of their dangers to ending and undermining organized crime. So what about
those theories? Well, you know, the problems with the mafia, I think, are, you know, quite logical. The mafia was hired by the CIA to take out Castro. So it's not impossible to believe they might have simply turned the guns around, you know, for the right price. And similarly, the CIA's got problems for that same reason. And the Cuban exiles, for the same reason. I think that more attention has to be paid to the military motivation, particularly in the wake of the Bay of Pigs and Cuban Missile Crisis. They were very angry at Kennedy in both instances. They wanted him to be tougher on Cuba. They wanted him to invade Cuba. They considered him an amateur. And with Vietnam in the wings, it's quite logical to think that with the enemies he had, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff level, people like Curtis LeMay, you know, you just can't rule it out. And the hit in Dallas was a military hit, in my opinion. I don't think you could do it with a lone person. I don't think you could do it with some people who weren't first-grade snipers. So, again, what we want is we want the truth with the Barkov. We want the documents from the military, which have only come in by the hundreds. You know, the CIA documents have come in by the hundreds of thousands. So have the FBI documents, because people have leaned on them. But the military, the CIA has been compared to the ant chickens pecking on the ground, while the Pentagon looms above the chicken coop, you know? The Pentagon is so much more powerful than the Central Intelligence Agency or the FBI. There's really no comparison. They're the powers, along with the insurance companies, I like to say, that run the civil and criminal, you know, aspects of the country to a large degree because of the decisions they made, how they wield.
Absolutely.
The environmental.
And all reporters are afraid to deal with the reporters just shy and demure and give it over when the intelligence experts arrive.
I don't want to lose my pet peeve about the environmentalists who I work with and endure. The Pentagon, single biggest polluter in this country, and almost nobody in the environmental community raises a finger again, much less names that calls them out seriously.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's
no
true. You remember
around.
The? Yeah. Go on. Sorry.
No. I've said it. You were saying.
No, it's, you know, the military as the polluter. I remember the late Robert Knight, wonderful investigative reporter who I used to work with, who did a series of studies looking at the ozone layer over Iraq and Iran as a result of U.S.-triggered war funded by U.S. weapons. And that's just like a, you know, they were just sort of studying that, and it was devastating. I mean, this is... The military is number one, the U.S. military, in destroying this earth, and the environmentalists, because I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but a lot of the funders are not free, and they're getting their big funding from people who are looking for certain kinds of programs and not looking for other kinds. And this also comes out of your work in terms of freedom of information. So where does this go now, Bill?
I think where it goes now is we had a press conference with the federal judge, Kuhnheim, who was the head of the Assassinations Records Review Board 30 years ago. And he's very disappointed in what's happened, and he's calling for a series of congressional hearings. And we're going to take up that call alongside our lawsuit. Because we've got to fight them on both the political and the legal fronts. We can't limit just one front. And to that end, I feel that we are making a headway because we're not trying to solve the case at this juncture. We're simply saying, give us the tools to get it done. And if we get these tools, we can pass these tools to the cold case folks on lynching cases and on the Martin Luther King and Malcolm X cases, where two of the supposed shooters in Malcolm's case have been exonerated and paid money for being wrongfully accused. There's a lot of good we can do. We just have to kick off the fear of being alone.
Absolutely. Now, Bill, how do people follow your work in particular? I'm blanking, forgive me, on your book. I know you've written extensively about this, but give us whatever ways to track your work and for people to keep themselves intelligent on this.
All you got to do is go to the Mary Farrell Foundation to follow the work we're doing on the lawsuit, for example. You should see it on the front page or with a couple clicks. And if you want to find my work, you really all you got to do is type in my name and Warren Report or Lee Oswald. It'll come right up on the net.
Great. Certainly it's worth doing. That's Bill's. His name is Bill Simpich, S-I-M-P-I-C-H. Some of us call him William too. He's a wonderful attorney here in the Bay Area. And as always, Bill, we appreciate the good information and the kind of work that you choose to take on that really benefits all of us and our being better Democrats and having a better understanding about how this world works. Break open, bring on the sunshine and the daylight. That's what we want. Be safe, Bill.
That's
come
it,
back.
Keep
us posted.
Dennis, work too. I love it.
Will do. Both fists up at once. Be safe. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. A very short musical break, and then we're going to spend a few minutes with our good brother Keith McHenry. It is not looking good these days for the homeless in this country, although nobody's talking about it. Keith is. Stay with us. Yaz Ahmad and Evisad's Chandler. Beautiful music. Thanks, Mike. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are now joined by our good friend and brother, Keith McHenry. He is the founder, longtime advocate for people feeding the hungry. Food Not Bombs is what he founded decades ago. He's working on that big book. We can't wait. Keith, welcome back to Flashpoints. What's the deal on the ground? Any let up in the suffering in terms of the people you represent? Things are, we're not hearing much about homeless and the unhoused from the Biden administration.
Yeah, well, the Biden administration made its first announcement on homelessness this week, and it seems chilling to me. And it's a warning to people. It's going to sound fluffy. It's Democratic Party rule by headline again. And they're going to remove 25% of the homeless from the streets in 2 years, is basically what the announcement is. But we already are seeing concentration camp.
Did you say remove 25% of the homeless? Is that a is that because we're going to help get them jobs and a place to live? Or is that by laws that continue to criminalize the homeless?
Well, it says they're going to continue to criminalize. We have, in fact, a new legislation for the state of California, which is very similar to, I think it was 4118 down in L.A., where, all these zones within any city or county can make it illegal to be in all kinds of public spaces, and that's kind of opening the door. The other thing that has started up is the CARES courts, and we already have people that have lost into the mental health system. And I've got one dear friend who is really on the verge of death, who was captured and put through the mental health system, and now he lost like 50 pounds in the last 4 months. He finally got out of the, but now he's a ward of the state. And so, this conservatorship thing that Scott Wiener was pushing when he got in.
Keith, move your. Could you move yourself a little bit? We're getting a.
Yeah,
I
want to
just. Keep going, please. Sorry.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, no problem. For some reason, you talk from my left side of my head. It doesn't. Isn't very loud. Anyway, so the CARES court has been instituted, and so there seems like it's going to be like a frog in boiling and where the water gets turned up. So, for instance, in Santa Cruz, they cleared out hundreds of people out of the benchlands, and we've been working for 2 years to try to come up with a graceful way to move people into secure areas where they could be safe. But instead, they drove them into the doorway. So there's 300 did get in what the homeless call the concentration camp, but hundreds of others are in the doorway. So you go around downtown Santa Cruz, and virtually every doorway has people sleeping in it. And in fact, even in the middle of the day now, you've got people sleeping in many of the doorways. So that we would warn the city that would be the case if they didn't provide some kind of accommodation. But what they did for the people that did go up to the Overlook campsite is they used to have like three or four vans would come down at 7 o'clock every morning. You could get a van to come into town. You'd get every hour they came by on a regular schedule. You could get on a van, go back up, come back down. Then they eliminated the vans down to one van and then started reducing the amount of times per day they came to town. So essentially most of those 300 people just sit in this like fenced in space with cyclone wire around it and just sit there all day. That's their entire trip. And that, I think, is frightening, because I think the public will think in this 25% of the people being removed from the streets are getting some kind of help. But they won't be getting help. They'll be placed in a facility like that, which will allegedly be free because you could get on a van and go to town every once in a while. And then I am concerned that as a homeless population balloons to that 40 million families that are facing eviction, of which millions have been evicted in the last couple of months, it'll get to the point where you just, you know, won't know, you know, the people will never be allowed out of these facilities, and that really frightens me. And I think a lot of people on the streets know that that's the case and are refusing to cooperate. But they have like a whole derogatory term called shelter resistant or service resistant. Well, anybody been through the homeless services would resist it on a heartbeat, man. It's not, you know, basically you're put into a database, you're controlled, and in like many people that get into the service system and then become resistant, you know, say it's like a minimum security prison. So then the other thing that's frightening is it's so cold here, and this is not, you know, I've been homeless in Boston with ice up to my knees, which you can read about in my book, Soup Street. It's not like that here, but it's still pretty cold, and I'm being rushed by, every time I come into Food Not Bombs, and we share food every day for over 1,000 days now, and tomorrow we're having our annual memorial for those who died on the street. At least 90 people have died this year on the streets of Santa Cruz. And we'll be reading off their names tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the town clock in Santa Cruz. But the people are, you know, that you can see this terror in their eyes because they just spent the night so cold in a doorway, and they begging for a tent or for blankets. And I bought like every blanket I could at thrift stores. They're gone. I bought all the I bought like all the sleeping bags that were on sale at Big Five. I bought every tent they had that was on sale, and people like are desperate. And that should, you know, there's supposed to be a government that helps people. They're not doing that. They're talking about population reduction, useful eaters. Let's just get rid of them. And that is frightening me. That is so, I think we need to, this is what it probably looked like when they started rounding up the homeless in Germany. And several of my friends that were in refugee camps or internment camps in Germany during World War II tell me chilling stories that there's an eerie familiarity to the events that are occurring now to what they experienced as children in Europe.
Well, and of course, Keith, there's all kinds of racist programs that have been experimented with in the United States and Canada, for that matter. You know, like self-euthanization programs. There's this suggestion of all this crap that's coming up again around overpopulation and stuff. I know you must be dealing with that, and have an understanding of that.
Yeah, well, there's a program. You know, a friend of mine had his aunt took advantage of MAID in Canada. That's a medical assistance in dying. And I started seeing interviews and newscasts of people who were fearing homelessness who had took advantage of MAID. So in Canada now, people are actually opting to be executed basically by the state for free. Euthanized for the purpose of avoiding homelessness. That is chilling. And there are people as young as like in their late 20s who are getting euthanized because they can't find adequate and safe housing. And the state, Canadian right. government is okay about that. And death with really, dignity is a valuable thing, but that's this is going horrible.
Yeah, it's misuse, obviously. The concept goes out the window with this kind of violence. Anyway, we're out of time, Keith, but we always appreciate speaking with you. It's been too long, so obviously we want you to come back. We're going to celebrate with you when your book is available. I also want to tell you that you predicted that soon there would be people in my doorways and in the doorways across the street. And believe me, there's a noticeable change here in San Francisco that I can see with my own eyes about people ending up in the street. And this is so amazing because meantime, there's a huge sort of middle-income housing apartment complex being built not too far away. But it's certainly not going to be for these folks who are starting to freeze outside the streets of San Francisco. Thank you, Keith. We're going to come back. Be safe. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you, Dennis. Fantastic. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Keith McHenry. Food Fight is the segment, and we talk to him. We try and talk to him every week when we can. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then I'm going to ask the question to our favorite expert. What the hell is nuclear fusion, and why in the freaking world do we need it? Stay with us. Pacifica Radio. Fusion, really? That's the title of the article I'm looking at by Carl Grossman, our good friend from the East Coast, our expert on all things nuclear and ugly. And nukes are back, Carl, big time. You got an administration that's in love with them. We got a governor out here that's in love with them. Now we've got, we don't need solar because we got fusion, right, Carl?
They never stop, do they?
Safe.
Absolutely.
Alternative to solar energy. No, go on, please. Sorry.
Well, but it's in your backyard. It's at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, just miles from you folks. Edward Teller's laboratory, indeed, Robert Oppenheimer, who headed the Manhattan Project. He had a big clash with Teller. Teller was pushing for the super, the hydrogen bomb. And yeah. Oppenheimer started saying, we physicists have sinned. And there was this big split. But that's how Lawrence Livermore got started. This guy Teller was given his own laboratory. He became the director of it. And that's where the hydrogen bomb was developed. And here, well, the hydrogen bomb is a fusion device, comparison to an atomic bomb, which is a fission device. And now out of Lawrence Livermore comes this notion that, hey, we can use fusion for peaceful purposes. In fact, it's the same old stuff. This purported breakthrough, which the mainstream media just swallowed and applauded, that has all to do with military uses of fusion.
All right. Why would we possibly need nuclear fusion when we have really turned the corner on solar? I mean, we have perfected it. It's modernized, demonstrated, effective. What is the deal here? The press is all over this. This is the miracle.
It's just, I mean, I
tell us what it is. What is it?
Well, it has to do with money. It has to do with greed, people thinking they can make a profit, the national labs thinking they can get a lot of grants and money. And also, it's almost semi-religious. I mean, these folks at these national laboratories into promoting nuclear, they call themselves nukies. And in terms of fusion, here's the first book I wrote about nuclear power, Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know. And let me read just two paragraphs. What about fusion?
Sure.
Then I wrote this in 1979. Go. The book was published in 1980. This has been held out by the nuclear establishment as a somewhat cleaner form of nuclear power, as the hydrogen bomb, a fusion device, is somewhat cleaner in fallout than an atomic bomb. Somewhat. Fusion is theoretically supposed to get its power from fusing nuclei together. This would be the opposite of fission, which blasts the nuclei apart. But to start the process, listen to this, extremely high temperatures are required, 100 million degrees centigrade, speaking of global warming, more than six times the estimated temperature of the sun's interior. Although Dwight Eisenhower, when he was president, suggested that the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission keep the public, and here's a quote, and I have the footnote where the quote comes from, confused about fission and fusion. This was the quote from Eisenhower. Fusion is a dirty, radioactive process, too. And in the piece that you're referencing, I speak about this purported breakthrough at Lawrence Livermore, and there's a new piece out today that I would suggest listeners go to. This is on Daily Kos, KOS, Daily Kos, because in the last few days there's been a good deal written about there's the military angle. So I've added on to the counterpunch piece that's was titled Fusion Really, with some of the nuclear weapons aspects. Meanwhile, in both pieces, Daily Kos and Counterpunch, the original piece, I extensively quote a piece written, this is in the Bulletin for Atomic Scientists, by Dr. Daniel Jasby, for 25 years, principal research physicist at the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab, working on fusion energy research, saying that, now this is this guy after 25 years saying, with fusion power is something to be shunned. His piece is entitled Fusion Reactor, Not What They're Cracked Up to Be. And in the subsequent piece on Daily Kos today, I quote a number of experts, and also there's a piece in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists about how it was this experiment at this National Ignition Facility at Lawrence Livermore was all about the military. Here is a wonderful physicist with a PhD, J. just a top physicist, Dr. Ramana, R.V. Ramana. I quote over to him at length, talking about how this experiment was modeled to help with the developing of new kinds of nuclear weapons. I also quote Gordon Edwards, who's the president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, talking about the nuclear angle. The big question you were asking, it's central, Dennis, why develop this lethal process, this highly radioactive process, what the hydrogen bomb is about? Why, when solar and wind and geothermal and tidal power and wave power and on provides all the energy, safe, clean, green energy that we can live with? Why? And again, it has to do with money, with greed, and an absolutely misplaced or semi-religious, cultish-like commitment of these many, not all, of course. I mean,
No. You know what it comes... This is where the Democrats sell the progressive movement down the road for corporate support. That's what this is about. They're addicted to nuclear weapons, and they need the nuclear power to keep the imagery safe, that we can justify one for the other. So here we go again, another nuclear atomic project to put us in danger. It is really, it's obscene. It's the worst part of politics. It's the money in politics. It's these weapons developers who are also these other kinds of develops. They're in there. They've got the power. We've got Gavin Newsom. He's, you know, he, if Biden doesn't run, Gavin is, and if Biden wins, Gavin's running after him. So here we got California liberals led by somebody who seems to love nuclear. What's the deal? Anyway, tell us, how exactly is this invention, as is fusion, as dangerous as the reactors that Newsom wants to keep open here on the West Coast in California?
Yeah, well, it's a version, in a way. It's fusion, it's not fission, of Diablo. And you're speaking about Governor Newsom. I can't believe, I mean, he's an intelligent person, and he's getting a billion, how was it, about 1.1 billion, is that the figure? To keep this, I've been around Diablo Canyon. The only industry, it seems to me, around that, this twin nukes there, hot spas. It's in a geologically hot portion of California, just like what happened yesterday up your way, north of San Francisco. I mean, building a nuclear power plant where Diablo Canyon was built is insane, utterly insane. To keep it running a day longer. I mean, the thing was supposed to shut down, thankfully, and Newsom wants to push its continuation. A lot has to do with vested interests. I talked about Oppenheimer, and he felt also out of California. He felt he understood the morality or the immorality of nuclear technology, of nuclear weaponry, and we physicists have sinned, he declared. But others just, at these out of the Manhattan Project came, you know, not only Los Alamos National Laboratory, which in fact was managed, like I think it still is, by the University of California, and one national laboratory after another was set up during the crash program to build atomic bombs during the war. And then comes Lawrence Livermore with a specialty in hydrogen bombs and here with fusion. In my view, it has to do with vested interest. These people have no one has ever accused me, Dennis, of being conservative. But sometimes government sets up an operation, and even if it turned out to be a lethal operation, those involved in it, not all, but many, want to just keep it going because it butters their bread. And you compound that with capitalism in the United States, with corporations just looking to make a buck, and then you have lethal technologies, murderous technologies like this being pushed. it's humanity being led off a cliff. We have to all understand what this is all about. That's why I wrote the cover-up book. I went to another national laboratory. It's one around me. It's called Brookhaven National Laboratory. Out of the Manhattan Project, they decided we needed a laboratory to push not just military, though Brookhaven has been doing military too, but civilian uses of nuclear technology, food irradiation, and nuclear-powered rockets. As you know, I've been very into that as a journalist, and nuclear power plants and so forth. And this is in the 70s. I didn't know too much about nuclear then, and I put my microphone in front of, I was working for WLIW, it was the PBS station on Long Island. They asked me to do, I had a program to do a program, they asked me on nuclear. And I went to Brookhaven Lab, put my microphone in front of scientists at Brookhaven Lab, asked, are these machines dangerous? No, they said, maybe every couple of centuries there'd be a minor accident, but the redundancy built into these reactors was such that you wouldn't have... I began cover up what you're not supposed to know about nuclear power, that book, the day of the Three Mile Island meltdown. I just was so pissed that these scientists, these nukies at Brookhaven National Laboratory, were trying to hoodwink, to bamboozle me and my viewers. And I've been very heavy, as you know, on the nuclear issue ever since. In terms of these national laboratories, in my view, they should all be shut down, as well as the 92 nuclear power plants in this country. In fact, over 400 in the world, shut down. This is a dead end. I mean, and it is some dead end.
This is, are we back? What's up?
Yeah.
Are you there?
I'm here, Dennis.
Sorry about
here,
that.
Dennis.
We got blasted off the air. Why don't you sort of talk about where you think this is going to end up, Carl? I'm not sure what you said, but maybe you could sort of put some closure on who's supporting this and where you think this is going.
Well, it's supported by people who, particularly these national nuclear laboratories like Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos, and they're all over the country. They were born out of the Manhattan Project, as was the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb and nuclear power plants from the atomic bomb, working with on fission and now fusion. The notion of fusion based on really the hydrogen bomb. Where it all ends up is apocalypse.
You know, to talk about the beginning for a minute, we're talking about Lawrence Livermore Lab and the invention of the atomic bomb. And I had the opportunity of spending some time with a guy by the name of Byrne Porter, who was a nuclear physicist on that project. And I was once doing an article about nuclear madness, and so I sent it out. I sent to a whole bunch of poets asking them to talk about the implications of nuclear madness on their lives growing up, the whole thing, growing up in the nuclear age and all that. And I got this letter from Byrne Porter, who talked about what it was like to be in Lawrence Livermore Lab the day after they dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima, and what it was like for all the scientists to read about the implications of their research. And he said most of the people in that room left, never turned back, and went crazy. Byrne Porter became a poetry writer and publisher and ended up being a biographer. But the nuclear age has devastated several generations of us, including you and I, Carl, and apparently this kind of dangerous technology is still going to be on the front burner and torturing still another generation of kids who are afraid of technology that should really be safe and that they should be able to embrace.
And another fault here, too, I mean, Dennis, you and I have been journalists all our working lives. Where has the press been on this story? I mean, in the piece that I wrote that's on Counterpunch, I quote CBS News. a piece online. Nuclear fusion technology has been around since the creation of the hydrogen bomb. Like, you know, what a nice comparison. Nuclear fusion has been considered the holy grail, another allusion, of energy creation. And now fusion's moment appears to be finally here, said the CBS piece. I mean, where is CBS? This is the network that Edward R. Murrow, speaking of holy grail of the saint. This, where is the New York Times lauding this great achievement? Not getting into what Daniel Jaspy, who's still alive, and still speaking out about how fusion is to be shunned. It's radioactive. Where is that reportage? It's nowhere except just here and there. I'm ashamed. Maybe, you know, decades and decades ago, the press was naive enough to boost nuclear technology, you know, maybe before TMI.
Yeah, but now everybody knows, Carl, we're out of time, but everybody knows what the deal is, knows where the money is coming from. Everybody knows that, for instance, NBC, MSNBC, they had their bout with being owned by weapons manufacturers. We've seen this time and again where the owners come into the editorial room and say, we're not going to do that, we're going to do this. And that's always been a problem with nukes. Carl, be safe. We'll talk to you soon. That's Carl Grossman. One of the articles is Fusion, really. That is in Counterpunch. And where's the other article, Carl? Very quickly.
Daily Kos, KOS, today.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
You have answered our call during this crucial time in KPFA's history, and we thank you.